Hi, this is Michael Shaw, and this is a podcast I call The Conversation. The intro music that you have been hearing and are hearing is by an artist called Kola, who was provided to me by Jacob Cassay, who we will speak to shortly. So this is not the first time that Jacob and I sat down to have a conversation on mic. Jacob felt like the first time we talked, he felt unprepared, didn't want to put out what he said, what we talked about. So we gave it another go, and we do talk about this at the beginning, so I just wanted to reiterate that. I still think there's some really intriguing stuff that comes up the second time around, and I hope you find it edifying. Before we get to that conversation, I just want to say that if you're listening in New York, I hope you spread the word to people out there, and I want to let you know that I would very much like to have conversations with New York artists and artists elsewhere as well. Though thus far, if you go to theconversation.podomatic.com, you will find about 40 episodes. Almost all of them are LA-based people. So you can look at images to accompany this podcast at notesonlooking.com. And you can find past episodes at theconversationartistpodcast.podomatic.com, where you can also donate to the show. Your support is very much appreciated. All right, thank you very much for listening. Let's get to the conversation with Jacob Cassay right now. Thanks for listening. So I'm with Jacob Cassay in the studio, as it were. We're both on the West Side, and we had spoken once before, but you felt like maybe having a little bit of a redo would make you feel like you could give it a better go of representing your work and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you run into it a lot. People hearing their own voice recorded is always a really, it's an odd feeling, and that was the first audio interview I've ever done, and I mean, given the chance to edit it myself, I just cut down the whole thing, and so I'm really happy you agreed to meet again. But like I said, I don't know if I'm gonna be able to do a better job, but at least, you know, it's like taking the SATs over again or something.
that's very poignant. I just heard a guy who wrote a memoir, a guy who went back and took the SAT 20 years later and got scored and everything. Oh, and yeah. I think he writes for a website, so it's like, you know, kind of a journalistic exercise, I suppose. But anyway, when we spoke the first time, I introduced you via my experience by talking about the way that I first found out about you, and I'm loath to start there again, but I just want to mention that as an aside, and instead I will say that people who have seen your work, and then people maybe who have read or heard about you will identify your work as being canvases, primarily your work as being canvases that have been silver plated and taken on a mirrored surface, to put it very concisely. So how would you describe the way you approach making that work kind of in a long-term scenario, in a long-term frame? Do you, as we talked about just before we got on mic, there is the analogy of having a room that you paint and you would never paint it the same way twice, because even though, you know, you take a roller and, you know, you start from the top and you go down to the bottom, or you go from one side to the other side, there's still going to be all kinds of inconsistencies.
Of course, so, I mean, you can never really do something twice. I mean, even as I'm talking, like, you can say, is this the same? Is this the same? Is this the same? It's like, no, because you have to take into account, you know, the time it took you to say, is this the same each time, and everything that's happened in between. I mean, that's to say that if you look at something, I mean, this is actually from Borges, I think. He uses the example of a dog and says, you know, if you look away for a second, and that's even dragging out the example a lot. If you look away for a second, then look back, there should be another name for that dog, you know, so that you recognize the limits of communication between experience when it's looked at such a close level.
Mm-hmm. So that is that one of the hallmarks, would you say, of the way you see your different pieces, looking inside that?
I just think that, yeah, they kind of have a sentinel quality for these things happening around them. You know, they...
You sure you want to use the word sentinel? It has a very military connotation for me.
Oh, really? I thought it was religious. Sentinels are angels.
But sentinels are also soldiers, aren't they?
Well, I don't know.
Okay. All right, we're going to need to do some fact-checking here.
Okay. All I know is that it's a watcher.
There you go. Okay, fair enough.
And that, I mean, that's kind of what I do too. Just kind of sit around and watch things happen.
Right.
Noticing things and calling them the truth.
Well, here's the important element of the way what you said earlier, which I don't even remember after I made that point about the painting the room, is that you've mentioned just today and then also in writing that you, a lot of association with John Cage.
Mm-hmm.
Is that also another sort of framework or way that you approach your work? I mean, the obvious analogy being, you know, silence and 433 and everything. I mean, that seems to be an ongoing theme that you've talked to me about before. Everything that surrounds, takes on, or acts in relation to.
Mm-hmm. Similar themes for sure. It's a burden having to deal with the history of it sometimes, though, because you have to answer to things that aren't coming from the most fertile point of your activity, you know? Of course, I've paid attention to that work, and I respond to it very positively. It interests me. But I can't say that I'm trying to pay any responsibility towards it when I'm putting out work myself. It saves me a lot of time in communicating to certain people because they have knowledge of that work much more than they have of my own. So it's a good lily pad for now until I'm able to flesh out my own, I don't want to say history here, but I want to just explore more ideas and continue to experiment and hopefully make sense from one project to the other.
What does that look like for you, exploring more ideas and seeing how things change or are similar from one project to another?
Mm.
Is that too vague a question?
No. I can only really say what it's looked like so far. And
that's, yeah, that's fine.
You know, I spend a lot of time thinking about how work is supposed to be. You know, there are these formal constraints that I place on myself to approach a situation, and then within those constraints I try to compose something that will have more atmospheric resonance within a group of work placed in a room or a building. And I just try to consider the amount of attention people will pay to certain materials and how they're used, and then set them up in a way to kind of guide people's attention and response to those materials. Like, you can use something usual, like, you know, paint on a traditional support and have it look very familiar, like something someone's seen 100 times. And then something like plated canvas is something more unusual. So you're pushing and pulling people's attention as they move throughout a room from being familiar to unfamiliar to dull to reflecting light. And it's a very physical and emotional experience. That's how I try to manicure these experiences for people that are, you know, willing to engage in them.
you're manicuring based on the specifications of the space.
Yeah, usually I'll try to come to a space with more than I need, and then kind of pare down things from there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'll have people walk through the space with me, and I have a couple of friends that I'll, depending on where I am setting up the show, I'll usually have someone around that can maybe, that I trust that can come through with me and let me know if I'm doing the right thing or...
Too much, too little.
Yeah.
Spacing, that kind of thing.
It's almost never too much, I hope.
Yeah, because it's usually very spare, right?
Yeah.
Well, how then to make, to sort of throw a complex wrench into the mix, but maybe not? Because you're, you've been, as we talked about last time, you have a fabricator, is that the right word? Or is, I mean, it plater?
On his site, he says that he's a chemist, and he is.
Okay.
I think he used to work for Oxy or DuPont before. So I'll go ahead and call him a chemist.
Okay, yeah, that's fine. So you have a chemist,
mm-hmm,
who plates the canvases that you've painted,
mm-hmm,
white at this point, correct?
Yes.
So my question is, see if you can anticipate where I'm going with this. You're doing a given piece at a time. He's doing the plating, though, so he kind of has control over that. Are you having a lot of dialogue before each one as to how this one's going to go, how that one's going to go, or not necessarily?
No, I prefer not to. It's been a little over 6 years now that I've been working with him, and sometimes it's not in the same place. I'll send him things, and I'm eager to get them back because I don't know how they're going to turn out. Each material turns out differently after it's plated. It's a very absolute process, though, so him being the one that applies the chemical doesn't... There's not a lot of variation on his side. It's a very absolute transformation that the material goes through.
And for those science geeks or just science interested people, how would you describe the chemicals that he uses?
It's electroplating, and all it takes is for a non-metallic object to be coated in a conductor. In this case, it's applied evenly to the surface in a very thin layer, so that all the nuances of brushwork are able to come through in the plating process, and those small differences are usually magnified.
How does he apply the chemicals to the surface?
The chemicals, I think it's blue vitriol, is applied with just evenly sprayed on the surface. And then it's put in distilled water, and ions of metal are adhered to the surface electromagnetically.
Hmm. Have you seen this?
Yes.
Do you have to watch behind a shield, or can you just be right there with glasses?
No, right there. I didn't wear glasses
last
time. It's,
okay.
You know, it's not very messy.
It's not very dangerous.
No, it's a room temperature,
mm-hmm,
process,
mm-hmm,
and... to get a better definition of it, and you can look up electroplating on Wikipedia. It's very extensive, and I was taking a flight home once and even came across an episode on the TV on the airplane of how it's made, and they were going over chromed car parts, and
mm-hmm,
it was identical to the process of how these things are put together.
Huh.
But the result is what I'm interested in. It's
sure,
having a reflective surface that can engage the space around it.
Well, all of that, I mean, that's all interesting, and it's important that you talked about it. The reason I was asking is because I'm curious. Basically, once you have six paintings that have been plated, or let's say you have 12, then you have a show where you have room for six paintings. You know, that's kind of, so it's like you have this palette, or you have these works where you have to decide, these are the ones that I want to use for this space. Is it that kind of specific thing?
Well, it's like decisions being expanded, you know, instead of figuring out what you're going to do with the surface of a piece of work, now you have to figure out what to do with the finished works, and those ideas and decisions keep getting expanded until finally you can say that the show is done. And making paintings in the studio is fine, and then approaching a space with more than you need is a good way to start for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then you pare down to what you feel is like making an appropriate amount of work in the space, something that won't overwhelm people.
Right. But what I was getting at is it's not just the amount of work, it's the particular works, or because they're not interchangeable.
No. If it's a series of work that's made in a similar way, they're rearranged to some sort of rhythm depending on how the room is set up. But I don't know, this is coming, I'm not very experienced either, so these are all kind of hopes.
No, I mean, it all makes sense. I think, and all that's important, I think where I'm sort of heading is the process of it. You talked about, you know, these expanding decisions,
mm-hmm.
and what I'm kind of wondering is, are all these decisions thus far sort of intuitive decisions, you know?
Yeah, I think that's a good way of giving to the audience of work, is to let it be known that the space that they're entering was considered as much as possible, and that, you know, a lot of time was spent there, and to kind of breathe life into the work. Otherwise, I might as well not be there, you know? A lot of the... This is kind of complicated for me to explain,
mm-hmm.
even to myself right now. But I'd like to just say that because a large part of it is putting work in a space that is, it's like my letting go of. It's the last thing I can do.
Yeah.
I'm not explaining that right.
Well, that's fine. I mean, if we come back to it through the back door.
Okay.
Because I'm compelled to make my next question or just point out, since we talked about this last time, for the show that you have coming up in May,
mm-hmm.
right? You are controlling the space in a particular way, in that you're going to have work in one room that's not going to have lights, it's not going to have any security cameras, etc.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Does that sort of address in a backwards or you know, rearward sort of way any of the kinds of things that you're trying to talk about? Or are those two different issues?
I think they might be two different things, but the show in May, I just noticed that there was a lot of distractions in the room.
Right.
And they were all, you know, presumably legally necessary things in the room, but I noticed that all these things are kind of something that make the place primarily something to do with exchange between people or a person and a security company or an electric company, or it being a gallery, a place of commerce, or, and I just wanted to cover up all these things and reiterate that this space primarily was a space. It has physical limits before anything else, and also the show is in May in Brussels, and it has a floor-to-ceiling wall of the garden outside, which should be the most, you know, the best time to view the garden, and so the lights won't be on in there, but I think it'll just be, you know, as pretty as a picture, just sitting there having light come in from outside, and
mm-hmm.
I'll put a bench in the space too, so people can just feel that calming light over them, and hopefully appreciate the attention that was given to the room to remove all these distractions.
Yeah. Something that you said, what you said a little bit earlier, suggested to me that the consistency, or the sameness, if to put it another way, of the work that you do gives you the opportunity to focus to a very large extent on the environments in which you show them. So even though this gallery in Belgium is one particular case where In fact, it just became particularly obvious in, you know, in designing the show that this particular room had a lot of distractions that really, but there are other much more subtle environments where, you know, you're noticing a lot of things. It's not just like you take a painting or you take a sculpture and you slap it on the wall or you slap it on the floor in this space. It's like you take all these things into account and that becomes part of the work. And part, you know, everything is an installation. It's not just work.
Mm-hmm. It becomes part of that expanded decision making that I was talking about earlier, and that, you know, there are more things to be considered outside of a painting itself. And, you know, to the extent that I'm able to control that, I will. You know, I can't control what you do before you enter the space, but, you know.
You could if you had people sign a you know, a waiver form or something, like take off your shoes or...
No, know. I wouldn't want to do anything like that.
Yeah.
A lot of the work appears the same because of these concerns with environments, is that I need a control. You know, I'm satisfied with the way that the paintings work, but now it's time to place it in a space. And... like I said before, if that space is less than ideal, then I'll try to change it.
So if you
the
just
same
have...
way that I had to change the canvas to make to you know to be something different,
right? Well, but it's always a reactionary action, isn't it? That you're because you're adjusting the space because the work is already made. You're not going to go back and make another work to conform to the space.
No. You're right. I think in that way, and again, bringing more work than I need, I provide myself some options. Like I'm able to order off of a menu.
Yeah.
And in that way, it's kind of like performing maintenance on the space, or taking like a managerial point of view rather than that of like creating anything.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes away a lot of pressure, I'll say. And
is it taking away pressure because you're shifting the focus or the perspective to that sort of more managerial, I don't know, practical maybe kind of viewing of the situation, as opposed to, I don't know, a, you know, masterpiece kind of perspective or something?
Once I have all the parts that belong in the space, moving it around isn't changing the density of that environment. So finding something that has a particular harmony to the placement of the work and the changing of the environment, I wait for that to, you know, kind of feel all right.
Mm.
And then I'll probably change it a few more times before I consider it.
Based on your own decision, or sometimes with you know, a second or third eye involved?
Yeah, sometimes with the help of somebody else, for sure.
Yeah.
I've you know, all this talking about controlling space, and sometimes I'll leave a final decision to somebody else. To be honest, it's, you know, sometimes
you make the final call, in other words, kind of thing.
Yeah, but sometimes decision making can become overwhelming, and I don't want to. I feel like I'd be making a mistake if I didn't ask someone's opinion.
Sure. Sure.
I ask people's opinions after it's done, too, you know?
Well, another question that I've been wanting to ask based on these constraints and environments is, have you had individual pieces in group shows or, you know, that kind of situation?
Mm-hmm.
And if so, you know, are you always there to make sure it's installed the right place, and et cetera, or do you have to let go of control in that situation?
Yeah, this can be very disappointing. And I do have instructions for individual works to be placed, and that's to be very low and alone on a wall, and then I'm usually happy with what they're absorbing from the space around them, but I've seen things just installed terribly.
Mm-hmm.
So I had
high and right next to things.
Yeah, I mean, they might as well hang it backwards and upside down.
Right. All right,
but well, you know, people are able to do whatever they want with them. You know, a lot of group shows happen with work that's not coming directly from me. I mean, people own paintings out there, and
yeah,
they can do whatever they want with them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, they're functioning the same way in storage as they are out in space to me. So you are ultimately
you're not being a fascist about it. You are relinquishing control within a reasonable constraint. Once if you are giving work to a group show, these are your essentially requirements. But if somebody owns a work, you're not, you know, putting a manifesto along with the work that goes around.
No, you know, once the show is over, things are completely out of my hands.
Right.
And I think that you mentioned something like this earlier about not working towards a piece of work that holds everything within itself. You know, the show, having a show is a great opportunity to have like direct communication with people that are willing to make the effort to go and see it. And it's and then after that, I don't take any responsibility for what happens to the
sure.
work.
Mm-hmm. So as we were talking about when we started, you just came back from Buffalo. But you're not from Buffalo. You're actually from near Niagara Falls, which is its own entity. Is it like it's a small city, right?
It's a city.
It's mm-hmm. a city. What's it called?
Niagara Falls.
That's the one where you're from?
Oh no, I'm from Lewiston, which is
right.
a town, and I live in a village within the town.
What's the village called?
Lewiston.
Oh, within
the town of Lewiston.
Oh, no kidding.
Within the county of Niagara.
Got it. Where's Tonawanda?
Why do you ask?
Because that's the idea that comes up on your phone.
Oh, Tonawanda is probably the closest place that a Verizon store was.
Got it.
It's kind of part of Buffalo, I think. Yeah.
I think maybe the subtext is you came down to Manhattan, New York, and Brooklyn as well, but New York, you know, right out of school, and you did have a sister who was already there, so that definitely probably made it a lot easier.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But what I'm sort of getting at is, you know, did you go through sort of the culture shock and, you know, kind of like big city overwhelm that a lot of people do when they arrive there?
I don't know, because my sister was going to school since I was... She's 5 years older than me, and so when I was 12, she was at NYU going to school, and I would visit her more and more, and I became more comfortable with the city very gradually. And so when it came time to move after I was done with college, I think I was pretty comfortable with the city.
Yeah.
And not so much Brooklyn at that time, but odd parts of the city, wherever she was finding apartments, like Spanish Harlem. She had a place right in Times Square once. The West Village.
She had a lot of places, yeah.
Yeah.
But if you do the math, since you're still quite young, you went into, started going into the city... What, in the mid to late 90s?
It was 1998.
Yeah.
Yeah,
okay, late 90s. So, while there was still some gentrifying to go,
mm-hmm.
yet the city was quite safe, and for the most part.
Yeah,
even,
I think so.
And Harlem was probably going to start gentrifying in the next couple of years,
mm-hmm.
a little bit. But by the time you got to Harlem, it was much later.
By the time I was living in Harlem, it was 2006.
Yeah.
So I lived at 139th and Frederick Douglass for a while. And at that time, my sister was living at 129th and Lenox. And so it kind of felt like it was nice. She was down the way, and I liked the neighborhood. It was easy to get around. It was off the B and the C. It was a little bit of a hassle to get to Brooklyn from there. But...
Why would you need to go to Brooklyn?
I had friends there.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I chose to live in a place that was cheap and convenient at the time, moving from Buffalo.
Yeah.
And I took what was available. I didn't put any effort into finding a place that would have been, you know, better for meeting up with friends or being close to my job.
Right.
So I stayed there for about a year, maybe a little bit longer, and then...
That was your first place? Because that was where the place your sister had, and then you took over.
Right.
Yeah.
And then I moved to Brooklyn.
Right.
Was
to Cobble Hill?
Clinton Hill. Yeah.
Okay. How did you wind up there?
A bunch of friends got a large place, and it was five of us living in a loft.
Okay.
Above a wood shop.
Okay.
It's kind of close to the Pratt school over there.
Mm-hmm.
The closest train was the class on G. But I had a car, so I would usually drive everywhere.
Did you drive to work in the city?
Yeah, I was working in Harlem still, so I would drive up there a lot. It'd be a lot easier than taking the...
How was the parking?
The parking? not easy.
Not fun?
No.
Yeah. It was a mixed blessing. It was like, I don't have to take the subway. And then you get there and you're like, oh shit, I should have taken the subway.
Yeah. Sometimes.
Yeah.
And then after that, I moved to Chinatown after 2 years of living there, maybe a little more. And that was the last place I lived in.
Is that a loft in Chinatown?
It was a storefront.
Okay.
So I had a studio on the first floor and a little apartment on the second floor, but it was very small.
Right. And you still have that place?
No. Oh, the place I still have in New York, I share with a few other people, and it's in... Greenpoint.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you like use that as a sort of an in-town studio?
It's a place to crash and get a little bit of work done. There's a couple other people in there that use it every day.
Okay. So I asked you earlier, and here it comes again, are you a bi-coastal artist then?
I don't think so. I'm set here for now, but... I spend a lot of time back in New York and back in Buffalo, and I really like it there. I don't, you know, during January and February, it was really nice to be here, and then I hear from all my friends back in New York that the weather's been gorgeous, and it makes me a little bit jealous. So I'll go back there for a couple of weeks during July, and then a couple of weeks during either September or October. I love the fall time.
Yeah.
And I had to spend one fall here in Los Angeles a few years back, and I don't think I can do it again.
Why? Oh, because you missed the changing?
Yeah.
All right, well, I think all this talk about being situated and whatnot, let's just advance to the ultimate question, which is one that I didn't sort of bring up in our first conversation. And I think you already answered it, really, but I'm going to put it this more sort of forceful way, which is, based on what we talked about the first time, it sounds like the busyness and the over-sociability, if you will, in New York maybe was a little something sort of inconveniencing or worse for you, and the appeal of LA was the anonymity.
Well, there's your answer. It took a while to find once I moved here, but it was an idea when I was back in New York that there was just more time and space to be had here in Los Angeles, and it's turned out to be true.
So even though you were, you know, your career was and is, you know, ascending, certainly ascended quite rapidly in a very short amount of time, that was not making it really practical for you to stay if that was something you chose?
I think that's based on everyone else's idea of what a career is, and I was...
Well, I want to give you every opportunity to debunk any people's assumptions.
No, I don't want to address anything in particular because that would be giving it time, and, you know, I needed my time back to myself, and that's why I came here. This success that you mentioned is something that was just, I mean, I didn't do anything for it. It was based on other people. Other people should have been interviewed about it. And my usual way I deal with things like that is ignore it, but it became impossible to ignore. So, yeah, it's based on other people's ideas of success. And, you know, my idea of success is being happy with what I'm doing. And I being out here now in Los Angeles, I'm able to have the time to read more and get back into writing and spend more time in the studio. And that's all I really want.
Was there a certain demand for your time that basically was going on that came to be untenable?
It's Jimi Hendrix said this in an interview with Dick Cavett a long time ago. That's, you know, good reviews are kind of the same as bad reviews, and that it's no matter what it is, it's something that's taking up your time. If you have bad reviews, you might dwell on them. If you have good reviews, you get fat and satisfied. Either way, it's just taking up your time. And, you know, what got me to that point where people were starting to recognize things, I had all my time to myself. And so when people start paying more attention, you have to, it's like having another job to
yeah.
put up with this attention. And it wasn't the right, it wasn't a very stimulating form of attention.
Sure.
I mean,
well, I think what's really important about what you're saying and why I'm asking these questions is that the grass is always greener, you know, and I think it's really important to sort of flesh out where possible why. And and I think that you have the being that you have the, you know, the foresight or whatever the best word is to recognize that it happened fast, you know, and other people should be interviewed in mm-hmm. certain cases and that kind of thing. On one hand, it might be taking the pressure off and taking the responsibility off, you know, putting it in terms of devil's advocate. But on the other hand, there's a lot of truth to it. And I like that, you know, that we can have this conversation and you can have this conversation and, you know, I don't know who's going to be listening to it, honestly, but it kind of gives me the opportunity to sort of ask face-to-face, you know, how do you see it, you know? And it gives you the opportunity to say in your own words how you see it or how you saw it,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to somebody getting a bunch of information from you, you know? Even though this is edited, I think we can say that as the limited degree to which this is going to be edited leaves a lot of room for a sort of clear voice to come through, as opposed to the sort of necessarily manipulated one that comes through in print.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to honor, you know, the, your generosity in doing this, but also,
I appreciate,
you know, not be too precious about it, I guess. Yeah,
I appreciate that, but like I said before, it's better just to ignore things like that. I mean, coming to the defense is acknowledging it, and it's really not worth paying attention to.
Right. Well, that begs the question, and we talked about this a little bit in a less specific or sort of less maybe interesting way last time when I asked you, you know, how plugged in you were as far as social media and what have you. And I think a better question is really, you know, how media saturated do you choose to be? Or is it really, is this really just something that comes down to your own stake or your own attention in the media world?
I don't think I have much, I don't pay much attention to things online. I'm not very good at navigating things. I'm easily frustrated by things on the computer.
You don't read online newspapers?
No.
So you're very sort of old school and not, definitely not a Luddite, but you sort of like, you like sort of more antiquated, as it were, kind of material.
I just, I mean, I will look at some things online. I mean, for video content and photos, that's where you have to go. But for, you know, books, periodicals, things like that, I like to sit down with them. I don't like always having to be in seat, the computer.
Yeah.
Like sitting in more comfortable furniture.
Yeah, well, I think it bears repeating that you mentioned last time that you did spend some time doing a little Facebook and, you know, whatever, email and things like that when you got home. And yet a friend of yours was saying, when you said, you know, how come you're not, you know, and your friend said, I'm doing that all day. So when I come home, I get a break from it, or I need a break from it, you know.
Who is this?
This is something that you said about a friend of yours, like maybe it was a musician.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So maybe you can recreate it since I'm stumbling over it.
Yeah, he said he's posting just so many things. I mean,
yeah,
political things, interviews with musicians, photos, updates on events that are happening in the neighborhood that he's in, and. It doesn't help me much that he lives in France, but I asked him, how do you keep up with all this and still manage to get a lot of studio time in? And he said that the computer is just a tool of his now, and that he doesn't have to digress too much to, you know, update the status on his Facebook and come up with interesting things. And me, you know, I'm usually too studio or something like that, or away from the computer, and It's an effort to get things done on the computer sometimes.
I love this line that this artist actually said about not being online. He uses a computer like to do animated work for mm-hmm. his work, but he, at least at the time, he insisted on not having an internet connection. He used the expression "the tyranny of connectedness," which I thought was great. Yeah. So, what's your policy then at the studio? What do you tend to listen to music? Do you listen to podcasts at all?
I do sometimes. It's depending on what I'm doing in the studio. I like a lot of quiet time, but there's times when I don't know. I spend a lot of time there, so it's
a mixed bag of everything.
Yeah. So sometimes talk radio, or God, when Mediafire was still around, it was still
what was that
downloading. 10 albums a day.
Oh, okay. It was like the Napster, more recent Napster.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you're kind not, of... Not Mediafire. Mega Upload.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just spend a lot of time in the studio. So there, I listen to a lot of music at home.
Everything? Or do you have particular types of music that you...
I get into phases. Right now that it's springtime, just listening to a lot of dub music.
Original dub music?
Like Scientist, King Tubby, Lee Perry.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Why don't we go back then, since you mentioned you spending a lot of time in the studio. How does that break down? I mean, would you say a large percentage of that time is given over to painting the paintings that are going to be plated, or is that only a small percentage?
I think I was running into trouble even talking about what music I might listen to in the studio, because it's very recent that I'm back in the studio. It took a long time to move from New York to Los Angeles, and I'm just kind of getting back into a rhythm, and I haven't painted one thing since I've been there yet. I mean,
what have you been doing there?
It's only been a month, but I had to remove a kitchen from the space. And put up a wall that would cover up some doorways that led to places that had other more convenient available doorways. I just I had to make the space my own, and that took a long time.
And you were doing a lot of demolition and construction?
Yeah. Nothing very elaborate, but
yeah.
There's a lot that needed to be done. The lights needed to be raised, and I think maybe I've put together like maybe five things since then.
Small.
Maybe. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Right.
And I'm using this time that I have a very clear space to go through old things that I brought with me that have been from studio to studio that I don't know why I keep around, but because the space is so clear and not lived in, I'm trying to use now as a time to sort through them and see if they're necessary to keep or get rid of.
How long do they get to hang around to, you know, decide to stay or go?
Some of them have been through three different studios, five years.
That's fine. No, but what my question is, how long now are you going to give them? You know, how long do they get to be stand up for judgment as to whether they're going to hang around?
Depends on what mood I'm in, I
right.
think.
Right.
There is a lot of storage space at the studio, so I may just hang on to everything.
Yeah. Sure.
I'm always worried that looking at old things will let me change directions of how I'm thinking.
Well,
you know,
this
so
was...
I like to ignore a lot of things from the past.
So this is asking a very specific question, since as we talked about last time, you did your first plate painting about 7 years ago,
mm-hmm.
when you were still in school. So are these older works that you're referring to versions of those?
Mm-hmm.
Are they something else?
No, they're, you know, small drawings and canvases that there's a lot of different stuff that never came to be anything more substantial. There's a lot of half steps in the whole procedure of, you know, putting together
right.
work in a show.
Right.
I really should just get rid of them all. I don't know.
Do you want to give one away?
What's that?
I said, do you want to give one away?
Oh, probably not, because I wouldn't consider it.
You would destroy
it. Yeah.
Yeah. Got it.
Like, I decided to reject something the other day, and a friend of mine was helping me move some things into the loft area, and he asked me if he could have something, and I was like, of course. And he's like, well, why not just this thing here? It's a piece of silver-plated paper. And I was like, no, you don't want that. And he was like, no, I want it. I'm like, well, you can't have it. You know, I will give you something, but just not that, because I don't like it.
Yeah.
So I don't want it to be out there.
Right.
So...
That's an interesting cycle back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of, you know, limitations and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, on one hand, once you put something out there, you have to relinquish control at a certain point. But if you don't put something out there that you don't want out there at all,
you should be comfortable.
It's destroyed.
With it.
Yeah.
But then again, I keep these things around for consideration over
right.
some things, you know, years. I don't know why.
Yeah. Well, I feel like I need to demystify, at least for myself, the life of one of these paintings. How long does it sit with you, and do you work on it in the studio, and do you think about it, and so on, before it then goes out, sort of for the final, ultimate phase, before it comes back to you? And what is that process like?
You're talking about the plated work in particular? I guess the life of those works... everything happens kind of quickly with those, because they're painted in such a way that it's, you know, it's very quick, and it just not a lot of time is spent on those paintings before they go out, because it's about the finished surface. So once I found a way to achieve that surface, it became an easily repeatable act. And that's not to say that I don't care about these things and I don't edit once they're finished,
mm-hmm.
but you asked.
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't take very long.
So then there's a lot of contemplation around the work that then has come back to you? And arrangements?
Even before that, you know, I've been working with it long enough that I can usually tell what's going to be worth sending out. I mean, I don't want to send it out completely blind, because there's a chance it could come back and I'd be unhappy with it. So I do some editing before they're sent out, and then after they come back. So I'd say there's about a 70% success rate.
What kind of editing can you do when they come back?
If there's too much difference between one and another in a group, I'll usually take the odd man out, so that it doesn't. If the works are meant to be in a group, I'll usually take one out that distracts from an even transition.
And does that work then live on its own?
No, well, there's a chance that it could, but if it doesn't, it gets, you know, trashed,
taken off the stretchers.
Yeah, I reuse the stretchers, and chances are I'll save the surface either to learn what not to do next time, or to dissect and you know, just find out more about the material. And
yeah, I like the way you said last time, I don't even remember this, you said in New York you can have a good night, but in LA you can have a good morning.
Oh yeah, yeah, LA's a place that's more centered around the morning, it seems that way. New York,
yeah.
New York, you have to work really hard to be a part of the nightlife. And that's where a lot of, like, the spirit of New York is, I think. And
do you feel like here, though, just to sort of even further flesh out what you were saying earlier, that you can kind of, A, stay under the radar, and B, you know, be as reclusive as you want to be? Is that fair?
I'm not trying to be reclusive. It's just the way that the city is set up. You have to make a real effort to go out and do anything. And so if it's not the most important thing to you that day, then, you know, you're not going to leave your house and do it. Instead, you'll stay home and get some work done.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's been nice about being here.
Yeah. I don't feel like there's anything else that we have to trot over. So thank you very much, Jake.
Yeah, thank you.
And we're out.